You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, bringing you politics without the boring bits. You can listen live from 10 o'clock weekdays on Times Radio. Just download the Times Radio app, retune your DAB radio, or ask your smart speaker to play Times Radio. Coming up on today's podcast, Rishi Sunak's nightmare before Christmas.
I just wanted to start by saying how deeply sorry I am to all of those who lost loved ones, family members through the pandemic.
He's been up at the COVID inquiry facing tough questions about his time as Chancellor. Then tomorrow he's going to face tough questions about his time as Prime Minister and his plan to try and get his Rwanda flights off the ground. Just how bad is it? And what's it like inside Number 10 when things go wrong? That's coming up in our big thing. But first, it's time for the columnists.
The columnists on Times Radio.
Yeah, a big, big day for Rishi Sunak, live at the COVID inquiry. We've got Libby Purvis and Tom McTague to give us their take on it in a moment. Callum McDonald's first here. What should we expect from Rishi Sunak's big day at the COVID inquiry?
Lots of eat out to help out, lots of furlough. And I think the underpinning message, I've just been rereading Rishi Sunak in The Spectator from August last year, which was in the middle of the Conservative leadership contest, or in fact, that's untrue, it was towards the end of the leadership contest. And I've kind of pulled out a couple of themes here. One, which I think we might hear today. One, that lockdown's knock-on effects were never properly explored. I think that's going to be the former Chancellor's take. That lockdown was not a mistake, but we needed more exploration of what the kind of effects were going to be. I think that's going to be a sort of underpinning thing. And then I think also just some interesting sort of nuances that may emerge today as well, that there was no socio-economic equivalent to SAGE, so the Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies, the scientists basically saying, here's what the data's showing us, here's what we should do about it. Well, yes, and here's some options as to what we might be able to do about it is more accurate. I think there might be a sort of suggestion that actually things like the economic impact of things like lockdown did not get the same sort of weighting when it came to sort of committees and decision-making process and all of that. There's going to be, I think, a bit of interrogation around why all of his WhatsApps are missing. He's changed phone a number of times, is what he said. But there's a suggestion, several of the papers say that he's going to get a bit of a hard time for that, actually. WhatsApp messages exist on at least two people's phones is the other part of that, I suppose.
But I suppose it depends whether or not they've drawn, you know, the thing about the Boris Johnson's missing messages is that everyone else around him has been called to this inquiry, whereas presumably the conversations that Rishi Sunak was having with his team haven't been sucked in the same way. And on Eat Out to Help Out, it was interesting. We've had both Chris Whitty and Patrick Vallance, the two top scientists, saying they didn't think it was a good idea or they didn't know about it. Interestingly, Boris Johnson, let's be honest, not Rishi Sunak's best friend, when he gave evidence last week, defended it and said there was no way they didn't know it was happening.
Yeah.
And you sort of wonder, actually, from Rishi Sunak's perspective, like you said, the scientists were thinking about the science, the Chancellor was thinking about the economy, the scientists had said we could open up. So why wouldn't he put effort into kickstarting the economy again?
Yeah, I mean, this is it. And it was largely welcomed, both at the time and sort of subsequently. Kate Nicholls, the chief executive of UK Hospitality, said that it was a significant boost for the sector when it needed it the most. So, this is classic COVID inquiry technicalities as to, was there a right decision? Was it sort of making the best of a bad situation? Was it simply sort of trying to weigh things up and choosing a route? Were there mistakes made? What should we learn is the overarching theme. So East Out to Help Out, which ran during August 2020. I mean, I feel I should declare an interest. I went out for some burgers, some discounted burgers.
Well, if we're all doing that, I mean, I mean? If I have to declare all of my interests of making use of Eat Out to Help Out, we'll be here for a long time.
Exactly. And part of the issue with the analysis of Eat Out to Help Out is there are varying analyses that come to different conclusions. And so it's really difficult to untangle actually what the sort of real life impact of it was and whether it was inevitable that we were heading for another wave sort of emerging out of summertime. Bear in mind also, there's an interesting part of all of this, that there were other measures that were loosened around the same time. So from the 4th of July that year, people were allowed to meet in groups of up to 30, although it was recommended to avoid groups of more than six. Schools were starting to reopen as well. The Alpha variant was floating around. So, I mean, there's all of that sort of stuff going on too. And then we do international comparisons because other places didn't have Eat Out to Help Out schemes like us, but still saw surges in cases. Mm. And places like Spain and France did allow holidaymakers to travel. They had a new spike in cases. So there's a lot of variables to try and feed into this.
In fact, and listener Anne-Marie's just been in touch saying, what about all the money wasted on PPE? They didn't work properly, and the loans went out to companies who will never pay them back. I mean, that's an interesting area there. Whether or not that's within the remit of the COVID inquiry is perhaps another thing. Let's bring in our columnist, actually, Tom McTague. Tom, if you were Hugo Keith, what question would you want to ask Rishi Sunak today?
Oh, my God, it's difficult, isn't it? I mean, I guess it's digging down into the value for money. That's the thing that seems to have really, I don't know, caught people's attention, the public attention, this sense of kind of corruption, this sense that money was handed out for kit that wasn't there when we needed it or wasn't, or, you know, we had to go through sort of dodgy means to get it. So, I mean, if you're thinking about the kind of inquiry's remit to prepare for future pandemics, yeah. I mean, that is something that I think I'm concerned about, this sense of kind of national resilience.
We're going to have to jump in there because I think we can go live to the COVID inquiry now. Rishi Sunak taking the oath. Baroness Hallett in the chair, Hugo Keith, KC, asking the questions.
Could you commence your evidence, please, Prime Minister, by giving us your full name?
Rishi Sunak.
Mr. Sunak, you have provided a witness statement for the purposes of this module 263374, which has been signed in the usual way with the Declaration of Truth. We're very grateful to you for the provision of that statement. Also, the further written material from members of your team, erstwhile team in then Her Majesty's Treasury, the statements of Mr. York Smith and Miss Joseph, all of which will, of course, be considered by the inquiry in due course. Thank you very much for providing the statement and for attending today. We understand that you wanted to say a few words by way of preface to the evidence that you'll be giving.
Thank you, Mr. Keith. Yes, thank you for having me here today. I just wanted to start by saying how deeply sorry I am to all of those who lost loved ones, family members through the pandemic, and also all those who suffered in the various different ways throughout the pandemic and as a result of the actions were taken. I've thought a lot about this over the past couple of years. It's important that we learn the lessons so that we can be better prepared in the future. And it's in that spirit and with enormous respect for all of those who were affected that I'm here today. And I look forward to giving evidence in a spirit of constructive candour to help the inquiry with its deliberations.
As is very well known, Mr. Sunak, you were elected Member of Parliament for Richmond in Yorkshire in May 2015. You then became, in January 2018, a junior minister at what was then the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government. You then became Chief Secretary to the Treasury in July of 2019. And most relevantly for our purposes, in February 2020, did you become Chancellor of the Exchequer after Sajid Javid, MP? You remained Chancellor of the Exchequer until July of 22, so after the conclusion of the coronavirus pandemic crisis. And, of course, you became Prime Minister on the 25th of October 2022, following the resignation of Liz Truss as leader of the Conservative Party. That is all correct, is it not?
Yes, it is.
Mr. Sunak, I'd like to start, please, just with some of the forensic building blocks underpinning your evidence today and the issue of the provision of material to the inquiry. In your statement, you set out how you rarely use text to communicate with colleagues. Your phone, you said, doesn't retain, and nor do you have access to text messages at all relating to the period of the crisis. And in addition, you said, although on occasion you use WhatsApp to communicate around meetings and logistics and so on, you generally were only party to WhatsApp groups that were set up to deal with individual circumstances, such as arrangements for calls, meetings, and so on and so forth. Is that broadly correct?
Yes, that is all broadly correct.
You don't now have access to any of the WhatsApps that you did send during the time of the crisis, do you?
No, I don't. I've changed my phone multiple times over the past few years, and as that has happened, the messages have not come across. As you said, I'm not a prolific user of WhatsApp in the first instance, primarily communication with my private office, and obviously anything that was of significance through those conversations or exchanges will have been recorded officially by my civil servants, as one would expect.
Evidence has been given to the inquiry to the effect that Mr. Johnson announced the institution of this inquiry in May 2021. And around that time, officials discussed the need for ministers and others to retain WhatsApps. It was a matter of debate, in fact, in WhatsApp communications between officials themselves. Around that time, April and May 2021, did nobody say to you, Chancellor, it's important that you do retain your WhatsApps, or we need to put into place measures for them to be backed up in case they become relevant to an inquiry?
No, I don't recall either those conversations that you referred to between officials, but you might have been referring to officials in Number 10 rather
yes.
than the Treasury. And I don't recall anyone in my office making that recommendation or observation to me at the time.
Rishi Sunak there, facing questions about the whereabouts of his WhatsApp messages. Obviously, WhatsApp has been a key theme of the COVID inquiry. Whether you like it or not. Listening into that was Tom McTague from Unheard, Libby Purves, Times columnist. Libby, how big a moment do you think this is for Rishi Sunak, whether it's on the detail of his individual decisions or just reminding people that he was Boris Johnson's chancellor, which is quite hard if you're trying to be the change candidate?
Well, I think it's an important period for him, but I think I want to sort of speak up for him regarding something that's been people gone on and on about, his eat out to help out. It was 12 days in August when everybody was hurling themselves onto the beaches and parks anyway with the new freedom. And all I can see there is a Chancellor who was put in charge of the economy, desperately worried about that economy, doing a small thing that he thought might help and encourage people to maybe get out again. He's a man who opposed lockdowns because he knew the disastrous after effects were going to come, which we are all seeing now, which include widening the gap between classes, you know, workers from home versus workers out in the world. And I don't think he should have to apologise for much at all. And I think in this inquiry, the way it runs, he's probably going to be expected and made to seem to apologise all the time. And I find this a pity, because I think of all the people involved in it, he was actually one of the most sensible.
It's really striking, Tom, that if you look at the polling in the Times today, more than half of people now think that Rishi Sunak did a bad job during the pandemic, despite the fact that his poll ratings went through the roof when he was getting the chequebook out and spending money on Eat Out to help out, but particularly the furlough scheme as well. And I suppose that's just really a reminder that the voters are pretty fickle, much like how nobody remembers that they supported the Iraq war anymore. Nobody remembers that they supported Boris Johnson anymore. People who voted for Brexit now tend to be a bit quiet about that fact, given it's not going hugely well. And actually, Rishi Sunak sort of trapped in that he did exactly what the public wanted. And now they're sort of misremembering and thinking, oh, no, it was a bad thing to have done.
Well, I suppose it's a reminder of politics and for politicians.
It's a very good point. Yeah.
You just ignore the polls, you know, and you have to govern in a way that you think is sensible for the country in the long term, because that's all you're going to be judged by when it comes around to the next election. You know. I don't know. Looking at that, I mean, I sympathize a lot with what Libby's saying there, because it sounded very much like he was on trial, didn't it? You know, that was the sense of that opening exchange, like. So why didn't you hand over your WhatsApp messages? It's kind of accusatory in its tone from the outset, you know, maybe reasonably, but he's already on the back foot. I mean, everybody who's going to this inquiry is on the back foot, and they're apologizing. And it was sort of, I'm reminded of like sort of Boris Johnson, you know, like never apologize, never explain. And that's all going out the window now. They're all sort of desperately apologizing for what they did. And I wonder whether it's in a sense because it was like a war government, a feeling of a war government where everybody rallies behind the government during a period when people are scared. But they didn't, the sense is that they didn't win the war. And so now we're picking over why they didn't win the war. So that, and they can't win from this position. They're in a sort of desperate place. And it's partly to do with the vibe of how everything has gone since, isn't it? The economy, and you know, if the economy was flying, if we didn't have, you know, the sense of chaos, maybe none of this would matter as much. But it seems to add to that general sense that this government has completely lost it. You know, there's nothing they can do. They could announce a positive policy that everybody in the country agreed with, and everyone would go, oh, well, why didn't you do this 5 years ago? You're useless.
It's a good point, that, isn't it, Libby? But that is politics. And actually, to some extent, because Rishi Sunak has tried to draw a line under what went before, that he, you know, the 30 years of failure, although he then brought David Cameron back into his government, and part of that, he hasn't owned what he did do during his time as Chancellor. He's saddled with the bill. He's promising to bring down debt, which isn't quite happening, to grow the economy, which is a bit flat. But if it goes back to the old thing, if you're not going to blow your own trumpet, nobody else is going to do it for you.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, I mean, there was a good piece by Matthew at the weekend, sort of pointing out all the things which this poor beleaguered prime minister has staggered through. And I think the idea now that this sort of, oh, the popularity is down now, everybody, and there are some people in the party who want Boris back, apparently. You know, I mean, that there's probably a few who want Liz Truss back. The whole thing is such a mess. And I think of all the people in the mess, Rishi Sunak has actually done his duty to the country rather better than most. I mean, I think he's making mistakes. I think it's a disaster that he's trapped in this Rwanda nonsense, which he's trapped in by Priti Patel and Suella. But I think he shouldn't be regarded as being on some kind of trial.
Tom, I suppose the big question in terms of when it comes to lessons to be learned from the pandemic is the extent to which delays to lockdowns, particularly the second one in November 2020, were as a result of lobbying by him because he was concerned about the economy and the amount of money he'd already spent to prop up the economy. And there was clearly, you know, there was that tension. Those arguments, you know, are still being played out now. Is it right to lock down and the impact you have on the economy and then schools? Or should we have stayed open and then risked more deaths, but the economy would have stayed going? And he, you know, clearly as the Chancellor, his job is to think about the economy.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem to me that this this inquiry has got like an institutional bias towards only considering the kind of medical outcomes or the, you know, the cost in terms of how many people got COVID at what times. And if we'd have locked, I mean, the essential question seems to be, should we have locked down earlier? I mean, it doesn't seem to be, should we have not locked down in certain ways? Should we have kept schools open or universities open or any of these things? And it's fascinating to me that we haven't really looked into this kind of Swedish case, which seems to be effectively a kind of lockdown, but a more of a voluntary lockdown that wasn't so severe. And it, you know, I was a supporter of the lockdowns on both of them, but I do look at it and I am questioning it now. Like, did it need to be so severe? Because Sweden has better results than we did. So I do want to know why that is. And is there, did we kind of lose our bottle at the start? I remember going to see Chris Whitty, I think right at the very beginning, his first ever public briefing. And he said very clearly, if this pandemic gets out of control in one country anywhere in the world, then it's out of control in every country in the world. There's nothing you can do about it. It's going to come into your country. And then once it's in your country, everyone's going to get it effectively. And so the question is, how do you spread that out? You know, you can't stop it. And as the wave kind of washed over us, I remember feeling that that had gone, like that sense had gone, and we were panicking and we were trying to stop it from washing over us at all. So I don't know. It feels like the inquiry is slightly skewed in one direction. I'm not sure that that is beneficial overall. So I do feel for Rishi in this respect, because he was effectively, somebody needed to champion the economy and other considerations, as I think the education secretary should have done a much better job. And remember, he was utterly useless at the time.
Gavin Williamson, of course, because lest we forget. Tony and Henley's been in touch saying, well done, well said, Libby. Sunak was the one voice of sanity in the cabinet during the lockdown mania of 2020 and 2021. And Hillary says, hurrah for the great British public. Let's put them in charge next time with their multiple crystal balls. That's the annoying thing about the public. They are inconsistent in their views. Right, let's turn our attention now away from COVID inquiry and an interesting sort of row bubbling under the surface in Scotland. David Cameron is threatening to close the Scottish government's overseas offices after Humza Yousaf met President Erdogan of Turkey without any UK officials there. This is obviously because foreign affairs is reserved to Westminster. So if the First Minister is meeting anyone abroad, then they're supposed to have a foreign office official there. It's not the first time this happened. And the new Foreign Secretary, David Cameron, is saying that if it happens again, they'll put a stop to meetings altogether. Tom, what have you made of this row? A sort of Westminster muscularity from David Cameron, that, you know, more than we've seen before, bearing in mind this is the guy who, what, this time 10 years ago, was setting out the path to an independence referendum.
Yeah, and I think making a panicked pledge right at the last minute to try and get it over the line, if I remember rightly, and then backtracking very quickly after the referendum and promising English votes for English laws, which I think we've had to get rid of since. Yeah, I mean, he's obviously all over the place on this, but I am sympathetic actually to, you know, what is called sort of muscular unionism. And I think it's just because of this, really, that are we a country or not? Like, are we a nation state that does certain things together and has a government that acts for the whole of the UK on certain things, not everything, but on certain things? And I think the question that, you know, answering that question has become difficult, because it's very hard to say, well, what is it that we do as an entire UK that is accepted across the entire UK? You know, do we, before Brexit, we devolved even the control of what comes in and out of the borders into the devolved administration. So when we then had to decide what we were going to do post-Brexit, it was fiendishly complicated, because it turned out that we thought, well, that, we can't possibly ever imagine leaving the EU. So we were happy to devolve these things. And so I think, you know, if you go back in time, there were once nationalized industries. There was a national health service that covered the whole of the UK. That doesn't exist anymore. It's been devolved into different parts. The army is absolutely tiny. You know, we don't have national energy infrastructure. It's, again, it's devolved. So what is it that's left that's holding us together? And I think that is a question that we need to address if we're going to stick around together in the long term. We need to have things that we all bind together. And foreign policy has surely got to be one of those things. I think there has to be a way of bringing the Scottish government into that. But we also have to act as a nation, or otherwise the whole thing just starts to fall apart, I think.
Libby, what do you make of this? And is David Cameron the right man for the job?
I don't know. He may be the right man for the job. I don't know. I mean, my nephew works for Aspen Foundation and has been massively admiring of how magically suave he was over there. But I am very encouraged by this idea of a tightening of the idea that the UK does actually exist as an entity, as against sort of soggy nationalist devolution in this case, an incompetent grandstanding SNP. I mean, the business about the gender change, you know, the overruling of their absurd idea of instant self-created gender change with no safeguards at all, such as the rest of the UK have. I mean, that was great. I mean, I do think you have to sort of say devolution was laid out, you know, particular things are your responsibility. You're not doing it very well. Education, not doing it very well. Ferries, not doing it very well. You know, so don't just go grandstanding off trying to make your own foreign policy or indeed make your own gender rules. You know, it's absurd. And I'm glad that there is now sort of rising this sense that the UK sticks together.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting.
Exists, indeed.
Exactly, it even exists. And yeah, if the UK government isn't going to make that case, then who is? I want to move on to another thing, because I thought this was really interesting. I watched Keir Starmer on Alan Titchmarsh at the weekend on ITV's Love Your Weekend. Very cosy. Keir Starmer and Penelope Keith making chit-chat. Keir Starmer, though, was setting out how he thinks Labour will become the party of the countryside, telling Alan Titchmarsh he wants more British food to be grown here.
I think we should have a target for 50% homegrown food.
Can you achieve that? Is that realistic?
I think we can. Firstly, we need to be ambitious about this. We need to work with farmers to make that work. The government can pull levers. There are big procurements for food into the NHS and other places. So there are things that the government can do. But we should take great pride in that. That is, you know, what drives our countryside. And it's very, very precious.
Libby, can the Labour Party, he went on to say he grew up in working class rural, I think on the Surrey-Kent border, and he knows the countryside and his parents used to keep donkeys and all of this. Can Labour really become the party of the countryside on top of everything else?
Well, the Conservatives have left a mighty vacuum there, pretty much disliked, certainly in my part of the rural countryside. And what have we got? We've had Therese Coffey and Matt Hancock. You know, it's all a bit depressing down here. I think they might. I mean, the Lib Dems always have a much, much better chance, to be honest, because people still have a sort of visceral fear of labour in some rural areas, but I think they might, and I mean the points about farming are good ones. You know, if he can do it, a certain amount of food security is something that should have been thought about long ago. And as I say, the Conservative Party, you know, traditionally a sort of squirearchy, has lost a lot of credibility in the countryside. And remember that rural areas have not had a very happy time through COVID. You know, having sort of problems with transport, problems with you know, poverty, problems with the coastal towns and so on. So I think he has a better chance than we think. But as I say, the Lib Dems nearly always seem to do that bit better. So we may end up with another coalition. Who knows?
And actually, Tom, I suppose the point is the way the maths works is that lots of rural areas, if the Lib Dems are in second place and there's a sort of general get the Tories out move, then they're more likely to pick up those votes. But it's a demonstration, I suppose, of Labour's confidence that now the leader of the Labour Party can go on Alan Titchmarsh on a Sunday morning, you know, not quite wearing his country tweeds, but not far off, and talk in the way that he was, in a way that would have seemed absurd not that long ago.
Yeah, I would say first praising Margaret Thatcher in the Telegraph, and then going and talking about the countryside with Titchmarsh. I mean, it's exactly what the Labour Party needs to do. I think there is also a thread that ties it all together, which is this sort of idea, it's a terrible name, but Securenomics, and this sense that actually the country isn't secure enough in too many things. So it needs some kind of energy security. You need some kind of food security, medical supplies, to go all the way back to the start of this discussion, you know, that we shouldn't be so dependent on, you know, dodgy suppliers in China for some of the most basic things that we need in case there's a pandemic. So I think there's something that kind of ties it all together there. And then it does come back to the nation state. And can the UK as a whole provide all this? I mean, it was one of the great arguments for the union during COVID that the Treasury, with its might, could actually deliver things that maybe the Scottish government couldn't because it was just too small. So I think it's all there. There's something there that Labour could really catch the public mood with.
Yeah.
But at the same time, she has to be a bit dangerous. I did think of British cheese and Liz Truss as I was listening to him there.
Tom McTague from Unheard and Libby Purvis from The Times. Of course, you can read Libby every week in The Times. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next, Rishi Sunak's Nightmare Before Christmas.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You're listening to the Redbox Podcast now. It's time for this.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
We've got a plan, right? We've got a plan to pass this legislation, and I want to pass it quickly, right? But I'm not hearing from anyone else that they've got a plan.
We're not sent to Parliament to be concerned about our reputations on the gilded international circuit.
Chris says that this is eat out to help the virus, and I thought that's funny.
Anyone who thinks that what the Conservative Party or the country needs is a change of Prime Minister is either mad or malicious or both.
Rishi Sunak's Nightmare Before Christmas. We've just heard him defending his Rwanda policy, right? His former Immigration Minister, Robert Jenrick, putting the boot in on the BBC yesterday. Who can have you been talking about when he referred to people burnishing their reputation on the international stage? Boris Johnson reminded us that Rishi Sunak played a major role in the government's handling of the COVID pandemic, which he's being grilled about today. And Damien Green insisting there aren't many Tories mad enough to think that another leadership challenge right now is what they need. But just how bad is it for the Prime Minister? What, if anything, can he do to turn things around? In a moment, we've got three wise men. Well, two of them are actually women, but for the purposes of this Christmas metaphor, three wise men, to try and come up with some ideas about how he could turn things around. First, though, Rishi Sunak giving evidence to the COVID inquiry. Let's take a listen to what he's just been saying.
I didn't ever describe it as a clash just between public health and economics. I think that's to think about it in far too narrow a way. As many people have alluded to, and I did at the time, there were a range of impacts. Many of them socioeconomic, the impact on children's education, on mental health, on the issue in the criminal justice system, as well as the pure economic impact. And it was important that policymakers consider the totality of those, and that was a consistent point throughout. But obviously, my particular responsibility was the economy and fiscal policy.
Rishi Sunak there while watching along Times Radio's Callum McDonald. Callum, it's striking that just over half an hour in, one of the main tickers on the rolling news channel is Rishi Sunak gives evidence to COVID inquiry.
Okay, I was literally just saying to one of our bosses there, it sounds like, in terms of tone, delivery and words being used, it sounds like the worst corporate work meeting you've ever been in. And that may change, and I think within that there is still some helpful stuff. I'm only saying that by way of the tone and the delivery and those sorts of meetings that kind of feel like they're dragging on and on and on, and we're only sort of half an hour or 40 minutes in. Now, that is me just making a judgment. Others may disagree, and that's fine. I think what you've heard there is potentially the sort of most standout moment of the last half hour. I'll mention another couple. One is that Rishi Sunak began by apologising to those who lost loved ones to COVID and also all those who suffered in various different ways throughout the pandemic as a result of the decisions that were taken. And I think that does set the mood somewhat for what we'll hear through the day, which is this kind of representation of Rishi Sunak as Chancellor at the time in terms of what he was trying to convey from an economic and fiscal point of view up against the kind of public health information. Now, he denies there was a clash in those things, as you've just heard, but I think that is the kind of mood setter, if you like, for what's kind of bubbling away now. He's been kind of quite complimentary of some of the decision-making processes. He said things like the COVID task force ideally would have been there from the start, but, you know, the start was the start, and these things came into existence and evolved and changed. He mentions the COVID Operations Committee, often referred to as COVID-O, and the COVID Strategy Committee, referred to as COVID-S. And so he liked that these decision-making processes were eventually brought in. And I think the other thing just to mention is WhatsApps. This was where Hugo Keith KC started this morning, was to question why on earth we didn't have access to WhatsApps from Rishi Sunak from the time of the pandemic. He said, which we were expecting, that he changed his phone multiple times, the messages didn't come across. He did also try to offer some level of reassurance, saying, I'm not a prolific user of WhatsApp. Anything that was of significance through those conversations and exchanges will then have been recorded officially by civil servants. So I think what's interesting there is he's trying to emphasise that he perhaps, in his minimal use of WhatsApp, played by the rules and there were official recordings of the decision-making process. Of course, we don't have all the messages, so we don't know.
Callum, thanks for that. Callum McDonald, Times Radio's very own Callum McDonald, watching along so that you don't have to. Very best of luck, Callum. Yeah, good luck with that. Right, let's turn then to our not three wise men, our three wise people who could offer some festive cheer to Rishi Sunak, or at least possibly shine a guiding star to help him to a better... Let's speak to the three people who know about these things. Katie Balls of The Spectator's political editor. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
You are bringing some gold to this discussion. Gito Harry was Boris Johnson's Director of Communications at Number 10. Gito, are you bringing common sense? Frank and common sense.
Fantastic.
That's good, isn't it?
I'll settle for that.
Kate Fall, Deputy Chief of Staff to David Cameron when he was in Number 10. Do you know what Myrrh is?
Not sure I do.
Right, fine, good. Well, we'll try weather out between us. Katie, just wanted to start really where Callum was just leaving off. Rishi Sunak has been explaining this morning that he was very close to Boris Johnson at the time. I saw the Prime Minister probably more than I saw my own wife during this period of the pandemic. Is it a problem for him that when he's trying to look forwards, so he's been dragged basically sort of, two and a half years back?
Well, I think it's been a problem ever since he became Prime Minister that he is often dragged back, and that's partly because you just have former Prime Ministers still in the House of Commons. Now, of course, Boris Johnson has now left the Commons, but I think much of his premiership has been about what do his predecessors say. There aren't many examples of, you know, Prime Ministers who have had that many active predecessors. It's a sign of the Tory dysfunction. And he also doesn't have that much time, so many of the decisions of previous governments, some of which he was clearly involved in as Chancellor, are things he is still having to grapple with. So I think it's symptomatic of his wider issues in his premiership.
So how serious, if you put all the things together, Katie, how serious are things right now for Rishi Sunak? Has everyone lost their minds basically by saying it's like Brexit all over again? Or is there actually some truth to his position being in trouble?
Well, I think it's like Brexit in the sense that you have different Tory tribes debating one another. And also, not only that, some of those Tory tribes see a policy. It's almost policy purity. So the policy that some are arguing for, if you believe Rishi Sunak when he says the Rwandan government won't take it, is one that wouldn't actually work. And if you do believe the Rwandan government is lying, because Rishi Sunak has told them to, it still is quite unclear how you would get the stronger version through the House of Commons given the left of the party. So I think in terms of irreconcilable policy positions, it feels a bit like Brexit. In terms of Rishi Sunak's position and the way Brexit has ended the careers, or you know, Europe has ended the careers of several prime ministers, I think there's still some way to go. I think probably the most likely bad case scenario for Rishi Sunak right now is his party almost starts to look like a death cult, a hot mess, which fights with one another, potentially even in a worst case scenario has a confidence vote. But I think he would win that pretty comfortably, and therefore no one would quite get what they want. But I think Labour would just have so much ammunition to say this is a Tory party that can't get anything done and only fights one another.
Gito, you were there at the dying days of the Boris Johnson government, where everything you touch doesn't turn to gold, in fact, quite the opposite. And, you know, this sort of sense of spiralling, you're unable to ever get back on the front foot again. Are those comparisons fair, do you think? Or are there just some people in Westminster who, a bit like Pam in Gavin and Stacey, just love the drama, just excited constantly? You know, it's been ages since we've had a new Prime Minister, so let's whip it all up again.
I think there's two problems. One is the Parliamentary Conservative Party seems to have this insatiable appetite for self-harm, and they can't seem to survive without wanting to sort of undermine, you know, another leader, and that's ridiculous. And they don't realise that this, in the end, there's only so much harm you can cause to yourself before it becomes fatal, and you die, and you take everyone else down with you. And the other is slightly more of Rishi Sunak's doing. I do think he needs to be more sure-footed, and those around him. For me, that chapter of cancelling a meeting with the Greek Prime Minister, at one level, doesn't matter at all, but at another, it shows a level of immaturity and messing up that is, you know, there's just no room for that at that level. But the problems he has this week, I think he'll get through today okay. I think he'll remind people that actually he did two things very well as a brand new chancellor at the time. He got a furlough scheme up and running, and then the eat out to hate to help out was well intentioned to save an industry that was in deep trouble. But what he faces over Rwanda is horrific, and he's raised the stakes there. Unfortunately, he was kind of nearly in a corner, but he's put himself firmly in a corner now, so that if he doesn't get this policy through, the harm to his reputation is huge.
Okay, Kate Four, then what about you? Lots of people have got in touch pointing out that myrrh is a spice used in embalming. You ought to be able to run with that. So there we are. Is Rishi Sunak's premiership dead and buried, Kate?
Well, look, I think he's obviously in a problem. I mean, look, this Rwanda bill, you know, the whole policy, Rwanda policy always seemed to be more like a narrative, you know, images of boats coming in, images of people going out on the plane, strong image, but the policy always seemed to me to be pretty weak. And I don't understand why he's spending so much time talking about an issue where he's losing trust on it. The rule of politics is talk about the issues that you can resolve. So I think he needs to diversify. He needs to take the fight to Labour. He needs to talk about things that make them uncomfortable, e.g. they don't have many policies. But look, Marissa, I was thinking the other day about, you know, times when I was in number 10 when things were difficult. And, of course, we had a run of terrible luck after, you know, the budget in 2012, the Omnis shambles, and on it went. And we could never really quite relaunch. Every time we relaunch, something else happened that went wrong. So it is very hard to regain the momentum in politics once you've lost it. And actually, it took us almost a year until the economy was doing better to get things going again.
Times Radio with Matt Chorley.
Very good morning to you. It's Matt Chorley on Times Radio, taking a look at Rishi Sunak's nightmare before Christmas. But it's okay. We are going to sort out his problems because we've got three wise persons who are going to offer up some top advice on what to do when you're in trouble. Kate Ford was Deputy Chief of Staff to David Cameron when he was in number 10. Geeta Howie was Boris Johnson's Director of Communications at number 10 towards the end of his premiership. And Katie Balls, the Spectator's political editor, has seen many, many prime ministers come and go. Right, let's focus then on his options, Rishi Sunak. Let's first of all look at actually what some people thought he was going to do last week when he called that press conference. Should he do a John Major? Should he do a put up or shut up?
Every leader is leader only with the support of his party. That is true of me as well. That is why I'm no longer prepared to tolerate the present situation. In short, it is time to put up or shut up.
Or should he follow the example of, say, Ted Heath or Theresa May?
It was with reluctance that I decided the country needs this election. But it is with strong conviction that I say it is necessary to secure the strong and stable leadership the country needs.
Gito, let's start with you. What should he do? Put up or shut up? Challenge his MPs? Call an election? Something else?
I hesitate to echo him, but at one stage, you know, when I was in number 10, I saw more of Rishi Sunak than I did of my wife. We sat down every morning around the table in Margaret Thatcher's old study at about 8:15 and went through the events of the day. I've seen him up close and personal. I've seen him with Boris Johnson. I saw how well they got on at that point. Obviously, things soured a little later on. And what I'm getting at is this is a, you know, clean living, hardworking, super intelligent guy who understands global finance and economics better than most people on the planet. And so what do? You play to people's strengths. So you don't try and build him up to be some macho man who's going to turn around little boats. You say, if the biggest issues facing modern Britain is how to sort of overcome major economic challenges and indeed take advantage of major economic opportunities, not least in AI, where a guy educated in the West Coast of America is better placed than most for that. Play to those strengths. But the idea that Rishi Sunak is the guy who blows out the sort of Greek prime minister and then stands up and says, put up or shut up, and I'm going to send people to Rwanda, and you just watch how hard I am. It's ludicrous. It's not credible. And actually, for a lot of us, it's not attractive, even if it was credible. So there is an opportunity to get back to what Rishi Sunak is there for. Why God made Rishi, if you put it that way, is to be a sort of calm, reassuring, hardworking, thoughtful leader of a country that is trying to overcome really difficult times. Plays to those strengths, and there can be advantages for him as well as the rest of us.
Kate Fall, you talked about when David Cameron's premiership got into periods of trouble. What do you think he'll be? What advice do you think David Cameron might be giving Rishi Sunak right now?
Well, I think I'm sure that he is a reassuring person for Rishi in his cabinet and also sort of dealing with lots of the very difficult issues that we're facing globally. But I think, you know, Rishi's got to start talking about things that he's trusted on, not just spending his whole time on the one issue that he seems not to be. He needs to talk about long-term, meeting long-term plans and the fact that Labour don't have many policies or don't like to talk about their policies as well. And then, of course, the big issue for Rishi, the big decision, is when he holds the election next year. And, of course, that's the question he's got to face. You know, does he sort of wait it out and hope the polls are going to prove the economy is going to prove and the party is going to be liking each other more? Or does he take the view that none of those things are going to be aligned and he's better sort of gathering the forces together and going in May? And I think that's the million-dollar question.
Well, in terms of when you might call a general election, I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? There's all this talk about his options and, you know, is Boris Johnson going to come back? Is Nigel Farage going to become a candidate as well? You know, some of the powers that any prime minister has is who is a candidate is one, but also when that election is, and that can, you can use that as a power over your MPs.
Exactly. And the fact is that at the moment, the MPs are panicking because they're worried about losing their seats. So the one thing that Rishi holds is the power at the moment to decide when that election is. I don't think there's going to be another leadership election. I think this is all talk about the post-election leadership election. And that's why he needs to try and unite the party and the MPs and focus on the next election, not on infighting.
Katie, what advice do you think Rishi Sunak should be taking then about what he should do, you know, today, this week, this month, next year?
So I think the problem on boats is he's ultimately gone for give both sides a bit, though I would say the right are getting more than the One Nation side when it comes to this bill. But the right are harder to satisfy than taking a more purist approach. So what Rishi Sunak could say is, if this doesn't work, up leaving the ECHR and the Tory manifesto. That might help with some of them, but some would say, why don't we do it now? And also the left of the party would say, "This is, we don't want this." Therefore, I think in a way, the best thing Rishi Sunak has going for him is not just that he can pick when the election is that a majority of MPs don't want to change leader, even if they don't particularly rate Rishi Sunak. And I think the closer you get to an election, perhaps to be able to crystallise that idea in their minds, which is, do you think in terms of your electorate, it's better to have ongoing talk and fighting, or getting to a point where, you know, months to go, it could be as soon as May, focus your minds. Now, that might be wishful thinking in terms of where the party is, but I think that's where a majority of Tory MPs still are. So using them to calm down their other colleagues might be the best way forward.
And in fact, you talked about that. I saw at the weekend a guy called Alex Dean, who used to work for the Tories some time ago, says, if the PM loses the Rwanda vote, we should go to the country. Snap election. This is an immigration election, a one-issue vote. Do you back us in trying to control immigration or not? And I sort of pointed out to him that if you look at the polling from YouGov in terms of the best party, the Tories are currently behind Labour, Don't Know and None when it comes to the best party on asylum and immigration. So I wasn't sure how smart an idea that would be either. They're playing this card. They think it's a big card for them to play, but they're behind Labour on this as well, Katie.
Yeah, and I think the other problem is it only works if you have a united Tory party. You have the same solution on stopping the boats. And that election would be different Tories saying different things. Even if you went for ECHR, there'd be Tories on the left saying, we don't support that. So I think that's the tricky thing about this stop the boats election.
So I'm conscious, Kate, let you come in there, because I'm certainly conscious having two people with almost identical names makes it quite problematic. Kate, for
exactly. Well, I agree with Katie. I mean, the problem is they don't actually have a solution for this problem. So going to the electorate, making that the centre point of their election is a very, very high risk, especially if the party's divided. And on the ECHR, again, back to Katie's point, it just sort of exacerbates splits, because one group of the party think that their international standing and human rights at a time where we're sort of fighting Russia up against China is exactly the wrong thing to do, and the other half think it is the thing to do. So it's just more Tory splits going into an election.
Finally, Katie Balls. Well, Kate Four might have a view on this. I realise Katie Balls and Kate Four is quite similar. Katie Balls, Nigel Farage comes third in the I'm a Celebrity jungle. We've got some Tory MPs wanting him to come in as a candidate. He says he's not going to join the Tories. Is that how high up the list, the long, long list of things that the Rishi Sunak needs to be worried about? How high up the list is Nigel Farage?
I think it's fairly high. I don't think it's top, but if you go from Reform being on 10 points to about 15 points, you know, if you think where the Tories are, you'll start to see a lot more panic. I think that defections to the Reform Party are fairly unlikely, because MPs will think they'll lose their seat. Unless they think, you know, I might as well have one great last stand to make a point. But it will just further exacerbate those right-left tensions within the party and potentially reduce this Tory, you know, if the numbers stay where they are, reduce this, you know, Tory result to something pretty disastrous if they can't curb the threat.
And we wait and see how Rishi Sunak's week pans out. Make sure you subscribe to the Red Box podcast so you don't miss any future episodes. But for now, from me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.